So undoubtedly, the name Pocahontas is a familiar one to most of you. We would generally associate her with the Jamestown Colony, one of the earliest settlements there on the east coast of the Americas. Pocahontas was a Native American or an American Indian. She was the daughter of a very powerful chief by the name of Powhatan. Powhatan was chief over about 30 different tribes there in that region. Actually, Pocahontas was a nickname. It was not her formal name. But Pocahontas meant playful one. Seemed to be an appropriate name. Colonial William Shackley said that as a child, Pocahontas would regularly come into the Jamestown settlement and play with the European children. So she had a very outgoing personality, and so that name certainly fit. Her real name was Matoax, but this was carefully concealed from the Europeans because of some superstitious beliefs among the Native Americans that if you knew a person's name that allowed you to exercise certain power over them, and some you'd be more open to the attacks of enemies and such. And so it was only later that she, Pocahontas, sort of revealed her true real name. There were many hostilities, of course, at this time. That's what we've been talking about a little bit tonight. Tensions between the Native Americans and European settlers is a big part of the history of our country. And it was during one of these skirmishes that Pocahontas would play a fairly major role. John Smith was one of those European settlers there at Jamestown. And he had, on a scouting excursion, had been captured by Pocahontas's uncle. And so he was brought to Pocahontas's father, the high chief, and they were preparing to kill him. They had actually had him lay down, and his head was placed upon a rock, and the various Indian chiefs were coming with their clubs to bash his skull in, right? The kind of a gruesome scene that was unfolding, and young Pocahontas threw herself on John Smith, kind of shielding her head with his head with her head, kind of neutralized this very volatile situation. She won out and convinced her father to show mercy on this European. She was only about 10 years of age at this time. And John Smith would describe the account. Here's a visual depiction of this, a little bit idealized here. There weren't a lot of mountains in that part of Jamestown and the colonies, but you get a sense here of her sort of over top of John Smith, sort of holding back some of these powerful chiefs in the village. This is how John Smith described it. At the minute of my execution, she hazarded the beating out of her own brains to save mine. And not only that, but so prevailed with her father that I was safely conducted to Jamestown. So this was sort of put Pocahontas on the map, made her known to the settlers. And this was only one of many acts of kindness that she showed. And we do also associate Pocahontas with Thanksgiving. So it came to mind as we were thinking about this season here that some of the Indians, Pocahontas included, were helpful in really helping those settlers navigate some of those brutal first winters. And so this too is recorded in John Smith's General Histories of Virginia that he wrote. He included additional accounts of how Pocahontas helped them. Every once in 4 or 5 days, Pocahontas, with her attendants, brought him so much provision that saved many of their lives that else for all this had starved with hunger. So we wouldn't have survived without the help of Pocahontas and some of her friends. So we see a spirit here of compassion that was evident on a number of different fronts. In late 1609, so just a couple of years after this incident where she sort of saved John Smith, John Smith was involved in an accident, a gunpowder explosion that caused some pretty significant injuries, and he was forced to go back to England to recuperate. And so word was sent to the Indians that John Smith had died. They figured it was just as good that they just thought he was dead and off the scene. And so that's kind of what everyone believed about John Smith within the Native American communities. About 5 years later, during another season of fighting, Pocahontas was captured by the European settlers. She was treated very well. They knew that she was the daughter of a prominent chief, so they weren't looking to make enemies, but they were using her to secure the release of some of the colonists who had been captured by the Indians. So it's kind of one of these pawn type situations, right? And so that actually went on for about a year that they kept her in the village with the colonists and limited her movements and sort of used her as leverage. And it was during this time that she encountered the gospel. She came to faith in Christ in the course of this year, a little over a year, and was baptized. She took the English name of Rebecca. Given the circumstances, this is one of the controversial aspects of her life. Given the circumstances, it has often been questioned whether her conversion was genuine or forced. Right? How much choice did she really have? And it's a valid question, but I think the trajectory of her life in the years that would follow would bear out the fact that there was a genuine conversion, even in the midst of some manipulative type of circumstances. We can't whitewash that, but that God really did get a hold of her heart, and she was genuinely converted. It was also during this time that she met and married John Rolfe. This is a depiction of her baptism. The picture itself is entitled The Baptism of Pocahontas. John Gadsby Chapman was the artist here. And this picture, 12 feet by 18 feet, is a huge mural, hangs in the rotunda in the Capitol. And we were actually able to see it just a year ago as part of our sabbatical. We were in Washington, D.C. It's a beautiful, moving depiction here. So you see Reverend Whitaker Episcopal Church here, the baptismal font there, Pocahontas kneeling. Right behind her would be her future husband, John Rolfe, who was an ardent believer and a very godly man by all accounts. And then you have this sort of interesting depiction behind him of many of Pocahontas' family, including her brothers, the most prominent one. He's taller than John Rolfe and dressed in all of his array, and he's actually sort of looking away from the baptismal scene. You get a sense, you're not sure how much these Indians are understanding or how much they approve of this. So it's just sort of this interesting scene of what was happening there in that baptism. She would, again, just shortly thereafter, marry John Rolfe. Rolfe's wife and child had died in the journey from Europe. So he himself had suffered tremendous loss. He was a very successful businessman, actually instrumental in bringing tobacco as a crop to the United States, to the Americas. He was described as an honest and discreet gentleman of good behavior. And he said this, expressed his heartfelt love for Pocahontas. It is Pocahontas to whom my hearty and best thoughts are, and have been a long time so entangled and enthralled in so delicate and so intricate a labyrinth that I could not unwind myself thereout. How's that for a poetic love letter, right? I can't get this girl out of my mind. She's so entwined in my heart that I can't. He kind of wrestled with the whole thing too, because she wasn't a believer initially, and what did this look like? He knew that he couldn't marry an unbeliever, but he was clearly in love with her. So he was a good man, and they had a good marriage. In 1616, so we fast forward a few more years, 5 or 6 years, she and John Rolfe returned to England. They had one son, Thomas, and they took their son and they went to England. She was to be honored there and recognized as an Indian princess. She was, in some sense also, there's also an agenda in this. She was seen to be a trophy of the gospel. And so we could view that as a bit manipulative, but they took her back to kind of demonstrate, here's someone who's been civilized by the gospel, right? And so, but she was recognized and revered and honored again as a princess. A portrait was made here of her what was the guy's name? Simon de Pas. I don't know anything about this artist, but he's the one who crafted this little portrait. And if you read it, of course, it's in Latin, and it references her real name, Matoka, now at this point. And again, recognizes her as a princess from Virginia. And Pocahontas were presented to King James I and Queen Anne. This is the King James, right? After which the King James version of the Bible was dedicated. So she had opportunity to sort of meet some pretty influential people. It was also in England that she was reunited with one John Smith, whom she had thought to be dead, right? She, of course, felt somewhat out of place in London, was anxious to get back to the Americas, but before they even reached the open ocean, they were en route on the River Thames, and before they reached the open ocean, she contracted what they believed to be smallpox and died at the age of 22. And is buried there in a little town called Gravesend. Her son Thomas was educated in London, but then returned to Virginia. And among her descendants, time to get into the significance of this, but among her descendants were John Randolph, William Henry Harrison, and Edith Bowling Wilson, the second wife of President Woodrow Wilson. So her heritage lived on. Now, the life of Pocahontas has been made mainstream again in recent years with the release of this Disney animated film, right, by that name, Pocahontas. Macker, you should see this. You probably have never seen this movie before, but she's saying no. The other one that came out was a movie called The New World. 2005, this one was released. And both of these editions do significant damage to the truth of the story. So if you remember maybe the Disney one, most notably, she saves John Smith's life, and they fall in love, and it's complicated, and, you know, all of these different things, you know. But she was only 10 years old at the time when that whole episode happened with John Smith. She was not of marriageable age, right? So that was not in the picture. This movie, The New World, develops a similar plot line, that she was in love with John Smith, but then John Smith had this accident, was presumed to be dead, so she marries John Rolfe as second choice, And then guess what? She winds up back in England, realizes that John Smith is still alive, and she's terribly torn now. There's a lot of twists and turns that much of which is not true and simply made for Hollywood. But there have been some modern attempts to sort of revive at least parts of Pocahontas' story. So a few lessons here. You don't have to be old to make a difference. You can make a difference when you're old. Moses was 80, right, when God used him to lead the people out of Israel. So Moses thought his time was done. He made an attempt at 40 to lead the people out, and that didn't go so well. And God said, no, now that you're weak, I want you to, I can use you. So it's not to overvalue youth, but I think Pocahontas is a great example. Think of the impact she had as a young 10-year-old girl in averting war. You know, she was able to accomplish something in bringing peace, actually a peace that would endure for 8 years. It came about not only by that act with John Smith, but her marriage to John Rolfe brought about a tremendous pact of peace. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Don Richardson's missions writings, but he has a book called The Peace Child. And he describes his work among tribal people groups who were constantly warring and killing each other, and he demanded that you must make peace. And so they took the message and the challenge to heart, and he watched with horror during a somber ceremony as they walked out into the center of the circle, these two chiefs, and exchanged children. And he was like, no, this is, I don't know what you're doing, but this is not... This is not good. And they said, this is the only way that peace will be, that lasting peace will be achieved. We're not going to attack you anymore, right? Because we're attacking ourselves by attacking you. And so Richardson ultimately would use that as a tremendous picture of the gospel and God's great love for humanity to the extent that he would sacrifice his own son. And so you just see something happened here in her life as a young girl and as a young woman, that she became a peacemaker. We should have an identity that goes beyond our ethnicity. Well, I kind of prayed about this at the outset. Pocahontas lived at a time of racial tension, that's to put it lightly. Certainly something that resonates with our day and age, right? This is a major issue in our world. And we don't know all the theology and her understanding of this, but we know that there's only one race, right? We all have the same blood flowing through our veins, the blood of Adam and Eve. And God has made one new humanity, in the words of the Ephesians 2 text that we read together. So we ought to think of ourselves as Christians first, and as Americans or Canadians or Brazilians or Anglos or African Americans secondly, right? It doesn't mean we can't celebrate our heritage. Those are good things. If you grew up in a German family, the Zeitemas have some fun traditions related to Wendy's background. Those are fun things. That's good. We don't lose that. But it no longer is our primary identity. And I think even in the marriage here of Pocahontas and John Rolfe, there was something that was more important than their ethnicity, and it was ultimately their faith in Christ. So we should have an identity that goes beyond our ethnicity. Three, God has often used people movements to advance the gospel. Again, this is a tension with Pocahontas in the story. We can't sugarcoat this. There was a lot of bad stuff that went on, and I don't know the degree to which there was manipulation involved even in Pocahontas' conversion. In the midst of all that, she was undoubtedly in sort of a vulnerable place, right? I think we could agree. 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old girl taken captive. So we can't just wash over that. And yet, in the midst of all of that, that turmoil, she was in a unique place to hear the gospel. And we just see that being played out over and over and over again. And we could just recognize it from history. Even you go back to the early martyrdoms of Stephen, right, in the account of Acts, that triggered great persecutions and the spread of the gospel around the world, right? The apostles now were sort of moved out of their comfort zone, and people were shifted about. And we see it with refugees today, right? None of these things are good. We don't celebrate the sin that's in the background, but we recognize how God sometimes displaces us for reasons that relate to the advance of the gospel. And finally, the gospel is a message of hope in a dark world. A lot of talk, if you do any study or reading on missions, you would know that there's a lot of critique of historic missions. The colonization that took place. So yes, the gospel is being brought into a country, but there's also economic interests, right, as the British or the French or the Americans come in. And so there were some areas undoubtedly where the message of the gospel was blurred by some less than stellar motivations and incentives. So that's a reality. And many would say, certainly many unbelievers would say, that we'd be better off leaving those unreached people groups instead of infiltrating them with all of our junk. Leave them in their innocence, right? But I think when you unpack what happens in some of these tribes, the Alca Indians there in Ecuador, I mean, these people are killing each other. We talked earlier about John Payton, who brought the gospel to the New Hebrides down by Australia. The atrocities, the fear, the superstitions, people living in fear of their life, being held under the sway of witch doctors. I mean, all of these things that are a part of that. And the gospel is a message of hope in the midst of the darkness. And so that's part of Pocahontas' story as well, that she saw something in the gospel that she didn't see in her own tribal religions. And I think we ought to be emboldened with people's need for the gospel. There's no sense in which people are better off without the gospel. That's a fallacy. It's a politically correct message, but it's fallacy. And we ought to be more committed than ever to bringing the hope of the message into the darkness of the world.